office and banned him to internal exile and finally hacked him to death with an axe. After purging their own party, the communists focused attention on the work of the Mongolian scholars whom the party labeled as anti-party elements, Chinese spies, saboteurs, or pests. In the anti-nationalist campaign that followed, authorities dragged the archaeologist Perlet off to prison, where they kept him in extremely harsh conditions merely for having been Tumurochul's teacher and for secretly researching the history of the Mongol Empire. Teachers, historians, artists, poets, and singers stood in danger if they had any association with the history of Genghis Khan's era. The authorities secretly executed some of them. Other scholars lost their jobs and, together with their families, were expelled from their homes in the harsh Mongolian climate. They were also denied medical care, and many were marched off into internal exile at various locations in the vast open expanse of Mongolia. During this purge, the spirit banner of Genghis Khan disappeared completely and was possibly destroyed by the Soviets as punishment of the Mongolian people. But despite this brutal repression, or perhaps because of it, numerous Mongol scholars independently set out to study the secret history, putting their lives at risk in search of a true understanding of their maligned and distorted past. Outside of Mongolia, scholars in many countries, notably Russia, Germany, France, and Hungary, worked to decipher the text and translate it into modern languages. Without access to the resources within Mongolia itself, they labored under extremely difficult conditions. In the 1970s, one chapter at a time appeared in Mongolian and English under the careful supervision and analysis of Igor Dorakhovits, a devoted Australian scholar of the ancient Mongol language. During the same time, American scholar Francis Woodman Cleaves independently prepared a separate meticulous translation that Harvard University Press published in 1982. It would take far more than deciphering the code and translating the documents, however, to make them comprehensible. Even in translation, the texts remained difficult to comprehend because they had obviously been written for a closed group within the Mongol royal family, and they assumed a deep knowledge not only of the culture of 13th century Mongols, but also of the geography of their land. The historical context and biographical meaning of the manuscripts remain nearly inaccessible without a detailed, on-the-ground analysis of where the events transpired. The second major development occurred unexpectedly in 1990 when communism collapsed and the Soviet occupation of Mongolia ended. The Soviet army retreated, the planes flew away, and the tanks withdrew. The Mongol world of Inner Asia was at last open to outsiders. Gradually, a few people ventured into the protected area. Mongol hunters snuck in to poach the game-filled valleys. Herders came to graze their animals along the edges of the area. Occasional adventurers trekked in. In the 1990s, several teams of technologically sophisticated foreigners came in search of the tombs of Genghis Khan and his family. Although they made many fascinating finds, their ultimate goal eluded them. My research began as a study of the role of tribal people in the history of world commerce and the Silk Route connecting China, the Middle East, and Europe. I traveled to archaeological sites, libraries, and meetings with scholars across the route from the Forbidden City in Beijing through Central Asia to the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul. Beginning in 1990 with a first trip into Buryatia, the Mongol district of Siberia, I pursued the trail of the Mongols through Russia, China, Mongolia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Turkmenistan. I devoted one summer to following the ancient migration path of the Turkic tribes as they spread out from their original home in Mongolia as far as Bosnia on the Mediterranean. Then I encircled the old empire by the approximate sea route of Marco Polo from South China to Vietnam, through the Strait of Malacca to India, the Arab states of the Persian Gulf, and on to Venice. The extensive travel produced a lot of information, but not as much understanding as I had hoped. Despite this lack, I thought that my research was nearly finished when I arrived in Mongolia in 1998 to finalize the project with some background on the area of Genghis Khan's youth in what I assumed would be a final brief excursion. That trip turned into another 5 years of far more intensive research than I could have imagined. I found Mongolians to be delirious at their freedom from centuries of foreign rule, and much of the excitement centered on honoring the memory of their founding father, Genghis Khan. Despite the rapid commercialization of his name on vodka bottles, chocolate bars, and cigarettes, as well as the release of songs in his honor, as a historical person, he was still missing. Not only was his soul missing from the monastery, but his true face was still missing from their history as much as from ours. Who was he? Through no credit or skill of my own, I arrived in Mongolia at a time when it suddenly seemed possible to answer those questions. For the first time in nearly 8 centuries, the forbidden zone of his childhood and burial were open at the same time that the coded text of the secret history had finally been deciphered. No single scholar could complete the task, but working together with a team from different backgrounds, we could begin to find the answers. As a cultural anthropologist, I worked closely with the archaeologist Dr. Tlok Surin, who had access to much of the information collected by his professor and mentor, Dr. Perle, the most prominent archaeologist of 20th century Mongolia. Gradually, through Tlok Surin, I met other researchers who had spent many years working secretly and almost always alone on studies they could never write down or publish. Professor Purov, a Communist Party member, had used his position as an official researcher of party history to study the shamanist practices of the Mongols and to use that as a guide to interpreting the hidden meaning in the secret history. Colonel Shakhtar of the Mongolian Army took advantage of his station in Moscow to compare the military strategies and victories of Genghis Khan as described in the secret history with those in Russian military archives. A Mongolian political scientist, Bolt Ertin, analyzed the political techniques Genghis Khan used in getting and acquiring power. The most extensive and detailed studies of all had been made by the geographer Sukhbatar, who had covered over 1 million kilometers across Mongolia in search of the history of Genghis Khan. Our team began working together. We compared the most important primary and secondary texts from 12 languages with the accounts in the secret history. We hunched over maps and debated the precise meaning of different documents and much older analyses. Not surprisingly, we found vast discrepancies and numerous contradictions that were difficult to reconcile. I soon saw that Sukhbatar was a literalist, an extreme empiricist for whom every statement in the secret history was true, and he had taken the job of proving it with scientific evidence. But Purev thought nothing in the history should be taken at its literal meaning. According to him, Genghis Khan was the most powerful shaman in history, and the text was a manuscript of mysteries that chronicled in symbolic ways his rise to that position. If it could be unlocked, it would again provide a shaman's blueprint for conquering and controlling the world. From the beginning of our combined work, it was apparent that we could not sift through the competing ideas and interpretations without finding the places where the events happened. The ultimate test of each text's veracity would come when it lay spread out on the ground at the place where the events allegedly happened. Books can lie, but places never do. One quick and exhausting overview of the main sites answered some questions but presented many more. We realized that not only did we have to find the right place, but to understand the events there, we had to be there in the right weather conditions. We returned repeatedly to the same places in different seasons of the year. The sites lay scattered across a landscape of thousands of square miles, but the most significant area for our research lay in the mysterious and inaccessible area that had been closed since the time of Genghis Khan's death. Because of the nomadic life of Genghis Khan, our own work became a peripatetic project, a sort of archaeology of movement rather than just place. Satellite images showed a Mongolian landscape void of roads yet crisscrossed with thousands of trails leading in seemingly every direction over the steppe, across the Gobi, and through the mountains. Yet they all stopped at the edge of the Ikhorik, the closed zone. Entry into the homeland of Genghis Khan required crossing the buffer zone that had been occupied and fortified by the Soviets to keep everyone out. When they fled Mongolia, the Soviets left behind a surreal landscape of artillery craters, strewn with the metal carcasses of tanks, wrecked trucks, cannibalized airplanes, spent artillery shells, and unexploded duds. Strange vapors filled the air, and peculiar fogs came and went. Twisted metal sculptures rose several stories high, strange remnants from structures of unknown purpose. Collapsed buildings, which once housed secret electronic equipment, now squatted empty among lifeless dunes of oil-drenched sand. Equipment from old weapons programs lay abandoned across the scarred steppe. Dark and mysterious clouds of unidentified chemicals shimmered eerily in this bright sun. Dark and mysterious ponds of unidentified chemicals shimmered eerily in the bright sun. Blackened debris of unknown origin floated in the stagnant liquid, and animal bones, dried carcasses, swatches of fur, and clumps of feathers littered the edges of the ponds. Beyond this 20th-century graveyard of horrors lay, in the sharpest imaginable contrast, the undisturbed and closed homeland of Genghis Khan, several hundred square miles of pristine forest, mountains, river valleys, and steppes. Entry into the highly restricted area was more than just a step backward in time. It was an opportunity to discover Genghis Khan's world almost precisely as he left it. The area had survived like a lost island, surrounded yet protected by the worst technological horrors of the 20th century. Clogged with fallen trees, thick underbrush, and giant boulders, much of it remained impenetrable, and the other parts had seen only occasional patrols of soldiers over the last 8 centuries. This restricted region is a living monument to Genghis Khan. As we traveled through the area, it seemed that at any moment he might come galloping up the river or over the ridge to pitch his camp once again in the places he had loved, to fire his arrow at a fleeing gazelle, to chip a fishing hole in the ice covering the Onon River, or to bow down and pray on Burhan Haldun, the sacred mountain that continued to protect him in death as it had in life. Our research team approached the Ikhorik like detectives searching a fresh crime scene. With the secret history of the Mongols as our primary guide, we navigated the plain and surveyed the primeval landscape from various small hills and mounds. On the open steppe away from the clear landmarks of mountains, rivers, and lakes, we relied heavily on the herders who were accustomed to navigating across the grass like sailors crossing the sea. A constantly changing cluster of Mongolian students, scholars, local herders, and horsemen accompanied us, and they intently debated among themselves the answers to the questions I was researching. Their judgments and answers were always better than mine, and they asked questions that had never occurred to me. They knew how herders thought, and although they were in unknown territory, they easily identified where their ancestors would have camped or in which direction they would have traveled. They readily identified places as having too many mosquitoes for summer camp or being too exposed for winter camp. More important, they were willing to test their ideas, such as racing a horse from one point to another to see how long it took or how the soil and grass reverberated the sound of horse hooves in this particular place versus another. They knew how thick the ice needed to be in order to cross a frozen river on horseback, and when to cross on foot, and when to break the ice and wade through the cold water. The descriptive quality of some Mongol place names permitted us to restore them to Mongolian and apply them to the landscape around us with ease. The text recounts that Genghis Khan first became a clan chief at Hook Lake by Harjurgan Mountain, which meant a blue lake by black heart-shaped mountain. The identity of that place had been preserved for centuries and was easily found by anyone. Other names associated with his birth, such as Udder Hill and Spleen Lake, proved more challenging because of uncertainty whether the name applied to a visual characteristic of the place or to an event that took place there, and because the shape of hills and lakes can vary over 8 centuries in this area of wind erosion and dryness. Gradually, we pieced together the story as best we could with the evidence we had. By finding the places of Genghis Khan's childhood and retracing the path of events across the land, some misconceptions regarding his life could be immediately corrected. Although we debated the precise identity of the hillock along the Onan River where he had been born, for example, it was obvious that the wooded river with its many marshes differed greatly from the open steppe where most nomads lived and where most historians had assumed Genghis Khan grew up. This distinction highlighted the differences between him and other nomads. It immediately became clear why the secret history mentioned hunting more often than herding in Genghis Khan's childhood. The landscape itself tied the early life of Genghis Khan more firmly into the Siberian cultures from which the secret history said the Mongols originated than into the Turkic tribes of the open plains. This information, in turn, greatly influenced our understanding of Genghis Khan's field methods and how he treated hostile civilians as animals to be herded, but hostile soldiers as game to be hunted. Our team went out repeatedly over a 5-year period under a great variety of conditions and situations. Temperatures varied by more than 150 degrees, from highs of over 100 degrees in tracts of land without shade, to a low of minus 51 degrees, not counting the chill of the fierce wind, in Hohonak Steppe in January 2001. We experienced the usual assortment of mishaps and opportunities of travel in such areas. Our vehicles became stuck in snow in the winter, mud in spring, and sand in the summer. One even washed away in a flash flood. At different times, our camps were destroyed by wind and snow or by drunken revelry. We enjoyed the wonderful bounty of endless milk and meat in the final summers of the 20th century, but in the opening years of this century, we also experienced some of the worst years of animal famine called Zud, when horses and yaks literally dropped dead around us and animals of all sizes froze standing during the night. Yet there was never a moment of doubt or danger in our work. Compared to the difficulty of daily life for the herders and hunters living permanently in those areas, ours were only the smallest of irritations. Invariably, an unplanned episode that started as an inconvenience ended by teaching me something new about the land or people. From riding nearly 50 miles in one day on a horse, I learned that the 15 feet of silk tied tightly around the midriff actually kept the organs in place and prevented nausea. I also learned the importance of having dried yogurt in my pocket on such long treks when there was no time to stop and cook a meal, as well as the practicality of the thick Mongol robe called a del when riding on wooden saddles. An encounter with a wolf near the sacred mountain of Burhan Haldun became a blessing in the eyes of our companions rather than a threat, and countless episodes of getting lost or breaking down brought new lessons about directions, navigation, and the patience of waiting until someone came along. Repeatedly, I learned how intimately the Mongols know their own world, and how consistently and completely I could trust in their astute judgment, physical ability, and generous helpfulness. This book presents the highlights of our findings without recounting any more of the minutiae of weather, food, parasites, and ailments encountered, nor the personality quirks of the researchers and the people we met along the way. The focus remains on the mission of our work, to understand Genghis Khan and his impact on world history. The first part of the book tells the story of Genghis Khan's rise to power on the steppe and the forces that shaped his life and personality from the time of his birth in 1162 until he unified all the tribes and founded the Mongol nation in 1206. The second part follows the Mongol entrance onto the stage of history through the Mongol World War, which lasted 5 decades, from 1211 to 1261, until Genghis Khan's grandsons went to war with one another. The third section examines the century of peace and the global awakening that laid the foundation of the political, commercial, and military institutions of our modern society.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World, written by Jack Weatherford, narrated by Jonathan Davis, with an introduction read by the author, Jack Weatherford. Executive Producer, Christina Harkar. Producer, Mike Charzik. Directed and engineered by Keith Reynolds. Production Coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2004 by Jack Weatherford. Production copyright 2010 by Audible, Inc. Throughout this audiobook, we refer to tables and or maps that will supply more in-depth statistics or visual aids for additional study. To download these PDFs, please go to the link on the product page where this title was purchased. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.